Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Elizabeth Carney. I'm the chair of the club's Business and Leadership Forum, your host for today's program, which is entitled The Transformation and Purpose of Capital. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Jed Emerson, in conversation with Donna Morton. Jed Emerson is a strategic advisor to family offices and investment firms, executing diverse approaches to investing for financial returns with social and environmental impact. Jed is an author. His newest book is entitled The Purpose of Capital, Elements of Impact, Financial Flows, and Personal Being. Co-author of the first book on impact investing, as well as six other books on impact investing and social entrepreneurship. He has been active in both fields for nearly 30 years. He has served as founding director and board member of diverse social enterprises and impact investment groups. Jed Emerson is a senior research fellow at University of Heidelberg's Center for Social Investing and has held faculty appointments at Harvard, Stanford, and Oxford Business Schools. He has taught social entrepreneurship at Kellogg Business School and the New York University Abu Dhabi at UAE. He's here in conversation tonight with Donna Morton, who is the Director of Impact at Lumen Farm. Here to have a stimulating dialogue, we welcome our speakers.
What do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about money and consciousness. But I want to talk about your new book. I want to talk about, I first heard about you 20 years ago through a guy named Tim Drayman in Toronto, Canada, who said, you need to know about this guy, Jed Emerson, who's reinventing people's relationship to money and working on blended values. So it's kind of exciting to be talking to you when you've been doing this work for 30 years. And I come more from working on climate change for 30 years. And we're both at a moment of pause and thinking. So tell me about this book. Why this book and why this book right now?
Well, as you said, I've been active in this area for a number of years and have done seven other books, co-authored or co-edited with other folks. Have worked in a variety of different settings in public equity, private equity firms, all exploring kind of like how do you structure capital to generate multiple returns, social, environmental, financial value. And I guess about 3 years ago, I was at a point where I was wrapping up some of the work I was doing with some families where I'd been working with them for about 8 years and started thinking, well, what should I do? Do I just get a couple of more families or, you know, how do I think differently? And I started reflecting on where our field was. And I just realized that I was feeling really empty from the whole process and experience. And as I thought about it, I realized that all the conversations that I was having with folks, and as I looked externally, I feel like all the conversations we were having as a field had devolved to questions of strategy and tactics and practice. And everybody was focused on the how. How do you do this? How do you measure it? How do you define it? How do you deploy capital? And it suddenly kind of struck me that we were all kind of lost because we'd blown by the first question, which really should be why? And why are we doing any of this? And then I kind of thought, oh my God, like I basically, as much as anybody, have been a part of this whole thing of just promoting practice in the absence of purpose, if you will. And so I just decided I needed to stop and I needed to try to come at this a different way. And so I decided what I would do is not give any more talks. So for each of the 2 years that I was in a kind of a reading posture, I gave, I think, two 10-minute talks. And I had been doing a lot of public speaking and a lot of promotion of impact investing and social entrepreneurship and whatnot. And I decided what I wanted to do was try to understand more about how we actually got to this place where people could think about economic factors in the absence of environmental and social factors. You know, how did we actually evolve to this place of living in a dualistic, bifurcated world where you could think about, you know, nonprofit versus for-profit or philanthropy versus market rate investing and all of that. And so I just decided I needed to kind of shut up and actually try to understand more about how we got here. So that's what I decided to do, is to pause. And I literally spent about 2 years. I read about 250 different books. I created a reference library of 4,000 volumes, because I would read stuff and I would come on things, obviously, that I didn't know about or had, you know, kind of a superficial understanding of. And so then I would want to go and I'd pull down the original volume that was Spinoza's writing or whatever it was. And I just, the more I read, the more I realized how little I knew, and the more I realized how we actually know how to think about a lot of the things that we think of as challenges. But we don't realize that because we're ahistorical in the way we are present. We basically, as a field, actually think that this is all new, that somehow nobody's ever thought of this, and aren't we clever, and all this kind of... And I thought I was pretty smart and clever, too. And actually, like, all we're doing is circling around a set of issues and challenges that really are fundamental to the human experience. And in the absence of understanding that we're just part of this flow and that none of this is really new, this is simply an iteration on a theme, we really are the poorer for not bringing forward history, wisdom, philosophy, theology, a sense of kind of place and presence in the flow of human experience. And so I just decided I wanted to stop. And so the book is basically the outcome of that process, where it was a hard book to write because every time I started thinking I had an angle on the book I was supposed to write, I would find the book that I was supposed to have written, but somebody else had gotten there first, kind of thing, right? And after a while, you kind of go, well, so much of writing is basically you find an idea and you read about it, and somebody else has already done like a really great treatment. And so you basically reframe it in your own words and you have a footnote, but you now somehow have turned it just a little bit. And so now it's yours, right? And so you'll find in the book, instead of doing that, I actually have pretty long excerpts from a lot of different authors and philosophers and writers, because I really felt like I was simply moving down a path that is a common path. And I wanted to kind of direct all of us to consider that, as opposed to always be rushing to get to a new answer, if you will. And what I really found was that there's a lot of power to sit more deeply with the fundamental questions, which then give you perspective. I'll say one more quick thing, which is Einstein is supposed to have said, but apparently he didn't actually say this, but supposedly Einstein said, if you gave me an hour to solve a problem, I would want to spend 55 minutes thinking about the problem and then 5 minutes thinking about the solution. And when I think about the state of play in impact investing, which is kind of my where I enter this conversation, I feel like we've all fallen into these postures of pitching, where the whole thing is premised on my convincing you that I have a solution. And whether it's a fund strategy or an investment instrument, or that as a thought leader, I'm always supposed to have like new and insightful insights to share that everybody can be like, oh my God, isn't that great? I hadn't thought about it that way. When in fact, if we just spent more time in reflection and consideration of the questions, I actually think the solutions would come much more easily for all of us. And so that was the idea, I think, behind the book. Mm-hmm.
So when I first got involved in finance, people told me that there's a cardinal rule, which is you can't ever talk about things like love and fear. Don't ever mention those words, which I think tonight we're going to break the rules and do.
Right.
Talk about risk, talk about opportunity and frame it in those terms, but don't talk about fear and don't talk about love. But I would love us to talk a little bit about fear and the role of fear in the investing story, and how we get to love. What did you learn in this exploration about love and fear?
Well, I think that the history of economics is largely, you know, that history. And yet, when we talk about economics, we say there are all these kind of extra financial, non-economic elements of life that we all acknowledge are present. Like everybody says, well, markets are driven fundamentally by fear and greed. You know, that's really what drives markets. And yet somehow No, because, you know, they have to be, you have to have econometrics, you have to have quantitative analysis, you have to have all of these things that don't actually consider the context within which capital markets function, but somehow that's okay. You know, it's considered either externalities or it's considered extra financial. And I think that when you really look at, you know, the course of human history, it is all this tension and interplay between a kind of a scarcity mindset and an abundance mindset. And especially when you talk about what motivates investors, I mean, surely there are people who simply want to make more money, and that's what motivates them. There are people who simply think in quantitative analytic terms. But if you think about people who have actually created wealth in the sense of value, I think oftentimes those are folks who saw an opportunity, they wanted to meet a need in the market, they wanted to bring a certain relationship to their connection with customers. And profit and money is simply a byproduct of taking care of people within a market context. And we don't really talk about that. And I know that's an area, and for me, that's a form of love, if you will, is to see a need and to work to meet that need and address it. And in the course of that, you get wealthy. And what happens, I think, the problem is that you have these entrepreneurs who are really motivated by passions and perspective about the world and where it's going and where we need to go. And I've got a solution for a particular challenge. And they make a fair amount of money. And then it gets to the second and third generations, and the story becomes one of wealth management, not value creation. And so you end up stripping out all this consideration of everything that actually, quote, made that family wealthy. And you end up then coming from this place of scarcity, because then it becomes about how do we save what's ours? How do we grow what's ours, even at the expense of other people? And you shift perspectives in terms of what is it that creates value versus what is it that creates money. And so the love, by injecting a consideration of love, you kind of distort the metrics and the framework and the analysis of traditional economics, and you call into question what it is that we're really trying to do. And I think many people have said that the issue with current financial capitalism is that we have a system where we are at the service of capital instead of capital being at our service and at the service of community. And so this, again, this dualism, this disconnect, this pulling apart of the value proposition to say that you can either talk about love or you can talk about business, but you can't talk about a loving business. And I know that that's a concept that you've done a lot of work around as well. Do you want to reflect a little bit on kind of your perspective on that in terms of how you've come into this discussion?
Yeah, so my background, as I said, is working on climate change, and I worked on climate change first through Greenpeace, and then I helped bring in the first carbon tax in North America and Canada, which was like its own form of bizarre obsession, where I wanted the tax code to reflect love and decency, which was this very deep, long chapter. And then I wound up working, building what I would describe as beautiful boutique businesses, but small and really hard to scale. And so I've spent a lot of time in the sort of impact social entrepreneurship ghetto, building really exquisite, beautiful, loving companies without the capacity for them to really bring in capital at scale and grow to scale. And sort of now, I think we're both in these 30-year cycle pauses where we're thinking about, well, so what needs to be different? And the first thing that I know that needs to be different is me, right? My consciousness needs to be different. I need to be love in everything I do. I need to be beyond fear if I'm going to have a chance to build something, and particularly a culture that's possible of really going to scale. But I also think there are ways of building love at scale, and I think we need to figure out how to do that. I think there are tech applications. There are ways of using, you know, the incredible capacity of a company like Google or Amazon, which went to scale, really went to scale, massive scale. I would argue limited consciousness, limited love. But there's things we can learn from that incredible growth potential of Silicon Valley right now, and we need to, because on climate change and extreme poverty, we don't have another 30 years, right? We have to actually get really strategic now and yesterday and certainly in the next 10. So this sort of idea of how do we become capable of really taking love to scale, and then what are the ways that capital can flow and we constitute business models that are capable of really going to scale, the love of Patagonia, the scale of Amazon right. yesterday.
But so let's say I'm a wealth holder and I hear you talk and I say that, you know, that's all fine and good, but I have fiduciary duty. I have responsibility to grow this corpus. How do you engage in a conversation with an individual like that when it comes to a perspective around, you know, let's call it loving capital, for lack of a better word? But I mean, how do you connect these worlds, if you will?
Well, I read this really great book, and the author talked a lot about mutual impact.
That was not a setup, let me just say.
No, but I think that's true. Like, I think the idea that we need to be at a moment in time where we have what Indigenous communities talk about as reciprocity, and we talked a little bit about this in our pre-conversations, that your definition of mutual impact feels a lot to me like the lessons I learned from Indigenous leaders around mutuality and reciprocity. And I think those principles are intrinsically important, that we want to be changed by the process, which you talk about in your book, about the process of investing ought to imbue transformation and change, and that we're a different person for having made that investment. Just like I think the entrepreneurs need to be different people for having meaningfully accepted that investment. If we can get to the place where we are consciously working together across divides, across sectors, even across capital flows, there's a lot that's possible that hasn't been possible. Because when people invest from fear in a company that is amplifying fear, this is the world we have, right? And we have the smoke post-apocalyptic climate impacts that we've all just lived through. And instead, there's these transformational opportunities. So where did your book take you in terms of mutual impact? Tell me about mutual impact.
Well, I mean, I think I started thinking about this in the context of the work that I was doing with families who were allocating, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. And I would sit on these finance committees and, you know, the conversations would all devolve to, again, kind of metrics and BIPs and allocations and fees and all this kind of stuff. And first off, I just got really bored because that's just not a compelling kind of thing for me. And then I started looking out at the field, and I felt like, again, all of our conversations had gone in that same direction. And as I watched a lot of the large financial services firms enter this discussion in a significant way, they seemed to simply be kind of exacerbating that perspective and thinking that somehow by introducing their product, that was impact, and that, you know, whatever it was, you know, like we're doing solar, it's got to be good. You know, that's impact, right? It's kind of like, maybe not. And then I would work with these families, and you would go through these processes where you'd spend time with strategy and hire a team, and you'd begin deploying capital, and you'd kind of look at each other at the end of a meeting. You'd be kind of like, so that's it? Like, that's impact? And it's like, I don't know. I just felt like there was something more. And I felt like when I think about different stages and nature of impact, I think of kind of broad impact that, you know, all capital has impact. All capital creates change in the world for better or worse. And so when we think about kind of that kind of impact, you know, that's broad, it's kind of distributed. It's not necessarily bad because, you know, it is the nature of, let's say, public securities that they have, you know, this, that is the impact profile, if you will. But then we could also think in terms of deep impact, and we could think of direct investing in, if you've got philanthropic capital, let's say in a community health program, if you have market seeking capital, let's say in some sort of a health tech kind of strategy. And that innovation kind of creates a kind of deeper transformational change for communities of interest, for stakeholder groups, for various actors. And then I started just kind of realizing that actually, though, and again, this, you do start to get into this other place, you start to realize that, you know, you change the world by changing yourself. And if all we're doing is taking broken investment models and structures and kind of wrapping them with this impact patina or something, and then going to scale and selling lots of it, that we're missing the boat here. And it, to my mind, it's similar to in the nonprofit sector, we used to always say that volunteers get more out of volunteering than the people they're volunteering to serve. And I think that in impact investing, it has been about, you know, my returns, my strategy, the themes that I'm interested in. And that's really driven the conversation, I think, for the last 30 years. And what I'm calling into question is the fact that this is really just a manifestation of this dualistic piece that thinks that my interests are separate and different from your interests, and that I can capture my interest in the absence of the community interest and value, if you will. And you begin to go into this philosophical discussion of self and other with a capital O, and this realization that, and again, this plays out really interestingly when we think about the nature of returns, but this idea that somehow, if I just broaden my sense of self to be inclusive of the other, I don't have to give anything up. There's no trade-off, because what's good for me and what advances my fundamental interests, both as an individual and as a member of a community and a family and a society, is actually what's good for you as well. And that can be just a phenomenally liberating kind of place to be, because it frees you from this sense of the individual in the absence of community and the individual by yourself on a charred planet that is the outcome of these strategies that simply try to optimize financial return at the expense and at the excuse of destroying the planet, of destroying families, of destroying community. And you really suddenly realize that no amount of money that I individually have can necessarily change that global dynamic. And the only way that dynamic changes is if I change my understanding of value and of impact and of returns. And so you get into this whole a much more profound reflection on the purpose of capital that we are missing, I think, today. We're basically, you know, building a house that none of us really want to live in, ultimately. And I think that's the trick. And we've confused kind of tool with task. We've confused the idea that we can create a clever financing instrument with the notion that actually then translates to meaningful kind of impact. And so I guess my question to you is, as you think of the scaling question, as you think of the evolution of the space, how do you evolve investing practice to be inclusive of the other, as opposed to simply drive more individual return and financial return to my bottom line at the expense of other?
I think one piece for me, and this came out of the work that I did with Indigenous communities, actually installing solar in a way that was hopefully creating kind of social benefit and making sure that the ownership of the projects, actually the majority of it, stayed with the community so that the benefit was actually really building an economic platform.
Non-extractive investing.
Non-extractive investing, where literally majority of the ownership stayed with the communities. And one of the things that was really indelible for me about that experience is I realized the degree to which we've got it completely backwards in terms of the idea that poor people have been left out of the economy and we need to bring them in because we're good people. Actually, we need to bring the people left out of creating the economy inside because they know shit about how to survive in really dramatically difficult circumstances. If you grew up in the hood, on the reservation, in the favela, if you grew up poor, you've had to be creative to survive. And most of the people I know living on reservations are vastly more entrepreneurial than the population, because most people have three jobs in order to make ends meet. Most families are full of entrepreneurship. It's just that there's no capital that sees these places, that wants to be part of kind of the transformation. And so somehow for me, there's something about this idea of genius being left on the table that we have to get right with, not because we're good people wanting to be benevolent, but because there is missing intel, there is missing talent, there is missing creative brilliance that could actually be transformational. So how do we start building the financial tools that can really solve that story? Because there is social capital, there's cultural capital, there's spiritual capital, there's all kinds of wisdom that's not making it into the world.
Well, and I think before you can get to the how of, like, how do you structure these instruments? How do you create these strategies? Again, I think we need to step back and realize that impact is not something we should seek to do to others, but rather something that we create in relationship and partnership with others, if you will. And again, it goes back to this idea that, and there's brilliant people creating a lot of great strategies and a lot of good products. So I'm not in any way kind of saying, gosh, we don't need that. I'm saying that work needs to be infused with a deeper sense of purpose and meaning and intent if we're really going to get where we need to go, and that's really what's missing from a lot of this conversation, that the answers, and it's one of the reasons that I'm not doing talks, but I'm trying to have dialogues and conversations, because I think I could come and say, here's my perspective, here's the solution set, let's all go over here, and you would do the same thing in a traditional kind of thing, whereas I think the trick is somewhere in between my experience and perspective and learnings and your experience, perspective and learnings, the solution sits in between us, and a lot of this, I think, again, I would say we actually know, but we forget that we know this, and we have to discover it together in relationship and partnership, and that asset owners, you know, need to understand that there are, in fact, conversations to be had around how much is enough, that if, in fact, you're achieving deeper value creation, maybe, you know, simply ending your life with a bigger pile of cash is not the measure of value for having lived your life. And that, in fact, you can do damage to your family by, you know, holding tightly, like when you grasp sand and it kind of dribbles through your fingers. And, you know, you watch various families. And, of course, the stories are legion of kids who inherit money, feel devalued. They feel like they haven't created, you know, this is a burden. I mean, all of this stuff. It's kind of, we have this fantasy that somehow wealth creates all of this great lifestyle. And we confuse that with a meaningful life, if you will. And I think we need kind of less style and more life in how we all kind of are present in this context.
Say more about the sort of personal dimension. So you've worked with a lot of families, and you've I've also seen it from working in wealth management and sort of constructing financial products, that there's so much pain around money. And at first, you know, I came from a working class family. I made these assumptions that the majority of the pain in the world around money was in people that didn't have it. And I was very focused on that story. But as I've matured and then worked in the financial system, I realized there is this amazing amount of grief. There's a huge body of pain that we're collectively carrying, particularly the people at the top of the 1%. Talk about the transformations that you've seen and what you think that space looks like. What's the work in the spaces between all of us that can heal some of those really, really, really deep sort of soul wounds around money?
I mean, it's a really tricky conversation, because I will say right up front, I can be as broken as anybody, and it's probably going to be a much better experience of brokenness if I have 5 houses and the best medical care that money can buy and all of that. So I'm not in any way kind of saying that, you know, gosh, we should feel so sorry for people who are ultra high net worth. I am saying that if we're expecting people to change, if we're expecting a shift in the conversation, we need to move to a different kind of discussion about like what this is really all about. And it is about politics. It is about class. It is about racism, institutionalized within our systems. And it is about how individuals experience that, whether you have assets or you don't have assets. It is how that is learned in terms of how we perceive ourselves in relationship to those assets. And so I think what I've just become more cognizant of, I guess, is that behind all of these, walls and Ferraris and, bank accounts, there are folks who are trapped in their own way. And again, it can be a really nice trap. It can be, golden handcuffs. But let's not forget that basically, there are folks who are also trying to find their way. And this is really the tragedy of some of this conversation, because when they have an opportunity to get out of the way of their money, if you will, and be more real, to be more present in the context of this, there's liberation possibilities on both sides of the divide, if you will. And again, I'm not actually sure how much I can share in terms of particulars, but there's a whole area that's evolving around what's called experiential wealth management, where people are taking high net worth individuals into community in order to have face-to-face conversation with folks who are affected by their investment decisions. So bringing asset owners into West Virginia to sit down with coal miner families and talk about their family, their experience, their generations of mining coal and what that's been like. And then to talk about renewables and to talk about, I want to invest in, the future post coal destruction, if you will, gives you a whole nother perspective. There are families that have been in conversation across the racial divide, where generationally, one family literally, owned the assets that enslaved other families that they were in dialogue and conversation with. These are very powerful conversations to have. It reminds me actually of the truth and reconciliation conversations that took place in South Africa. And I feel like we have an economic apartheid that is in action today. And what I'm trying to get people to do is to stop talking about their goddamn strategy and talk about what underscores and gives life to that strategy. And not to be so focused on, I have a friend who was a hedge fund manager and she cashed out. And in one of our conversations, not one of my clients, but just a friend. And she said, the worst thing about this is everybody looks at me now through this lens of my money. And either my friends view me as being different or, I'm supposed to be different in terms of the house and the car and everything else. And then, of course, any wealth advisor, as soon as you sit down, they say, okay, here's your profile. This is what your allocation should look like. And she just hates that part of the experience of being a wealth holder. And so I guess all I'm saying is that they wealth holders are trapped in this role, if you will. And if we're going to really be liberated, we have to liberate ourselves concurrently. In certain Buddhist traditions, you cannot achieve nirvana unless all of the people in your community achieve nirvana and have enlightenment. And in this same way, we cannot have economic liberation unless all are liberated. And that's kind of what I'm arguing for, is a deeper pursuit of those ideas and to look at, how do you restructure the terms of capital? You think of cooperatives, and in the cooperative community, you can actually have different kind of tranches of ownership where you have a call on revenue, you have a call on governance, you have a call on fixed assets of the enterprise, and you can break out kind of the roles so that you can ensure that the ownership remains with the workers and outside investors are able to help capitalize the cooperative in a different way. A traditional approach to capitalism doesn't allow for that. And this idea, the part of what I find really offensive is that we now have allowed the impact investing community to be dominated by traditional financial solutions. So for some reason, we seem to think that the strategies that create wealth down in Silicon Valley are the strategies that are going to create wealth in the Bayview Hunter Point. And it's kind of like, no, you know, like a five, you know, whatever, a 7-year fund with 2 1-year extensions, and you start, you know, you've got to be deployed in the first 5 years and then you harvest in the last 10, I mean, last five. That doesn't work. We're trying to really change the fundamentals of capitalism, and we're not going to do that by using the same mindset around the tools of capitalism. But that's what we're doing. We're not really stepping back and saying, how do we rethink the whole equation and then create tools that reflect where we want to go as opposed to where we've been?
So there's something about, I love that you invoked the truth and reconciliation process. So I'm a Canadian, and one of the things that was really powerful that Canada imported from South Africa was the truth and reconciliation process with First Nations, with Native communities. And those conversations were, well, they've altered the course of Canada by owning the genocide, by owning the colonization of Indigenous lands. We're tonight on Ohlone land. This is Native land. This is a people's traditional territory. And there's a lot of presenters now in Canada, before people speak, they talk about this is this people's traditional territory, and I want to recognize that that's where we are. And so I think I'm curious about your take on this moment in America and truth and transparency and reconciliation, and how does that healing happen? What did you learn on your journey building this book, pulling back and pausing and going deep and focusing in a more contemplative space? Where did you get to in terms of what happens next in this kind of grand experiment that isn't just capitalism and impact in America, but I would argue calls for a fundamental reinvention of what America is in the world, economically, but beyond that? Where did you get to on that? I know it's a wild card question, but...
I'm like,
but
oh, that question.
That question.
Sure. No, I have no idea. I mean, I think that... I do have an idea. I think that what I was struck by when you read history and when you sit with the knowledge that I think has accumulated over time is this idea that you cannot enter the conversation with your mouth open. You can't, you know, we have to have more humility in terms of how we approach all of this. We have to own... You have to own your shit, right? And people don't want to do that. Like everybody seems to be, I don't know what, like pointing at other people. And I wish we could just kind of pause and just listen. And for me, the listening starts with being historically based, listening to the human experience of the whole community, not the Western cultural perspective as the dominant perspective. And in the book, I talk about how, you know, a shortcoming of the book is that because I'm exploring, you know, modern financial capitalism and issues and challenges therein, it is a Western cultural perspective. I'm a 59-year-old white guy. I have a perspective that's embedded in that experience. And so I try to say in the book that basically it's not for me to kind of call out, you know, the First Nations perspective or the perspective of people who are incarcerated or whatever it is. It is for me to pause and stop talking in order to engage in a conversation so that I can actually hear. And the problem is that because we come from this fear place, because we come from a scarcity place, because we come from a, you know, how do I get what's mine kind of orientation, we basically start from this place of self. We don't begin from this place of how do I really understand my relation, my connection, my links to this much broader experience of humanity, if you will. And because when you go into it with that head, you kind of go, wow, like I'm not as smart, clever, or good looking as I really thought I was, you know, which you all know because you're here. But I think that... It's not so much that I have an idea as to where any of the answers are to the question that you framed. It's what I'm saying is that our approach to finding those solutions needs to be fundamentally different from the way we're approaching it now. And especially when it comes to economics and wealth and the investment of capital. You know, I look, for example, at the opportunity zones, and, you know, I know a lot of people are excited about that in the sense of this is going to bring new investment capital into, you know, underserved communities and all that that haven't had access to capital. But when I look at them, I see kind of like new market tax credits. I see, you know, all of the things that have been done year over year by every administration rolling these things out, but nobody is really stopping and saying, well, wait a minute, like maybe the fundamental way that we think about economics, you know, in these communities is just wrong. It's just the wrong way to think about it. And there are other ways that we could frame the question that don't begin with a solution being that ultra-high net worth people should get yet one more tax advantage for directing capital to places that are basically domestic emerging markets that they've ignored for the last 40 years, you know? So I'm just saying that that's really where it's at, and that it's a set of principles more than a set of solutions that I'm kind of asking us to reflect on, out of which possible, you know, experiments and solutions, I hope, will emerge. But they have to be connected to the other. They can't be driven by the asset owners. They can't be driven by the politicians. They can't be driven by activists who have a vested interest in a certain strategy being adopted. And all of those sets of actors have to be a part of this, but none of them have the solution, you know, or else we wouldn't be here right now grappling in such a challenging way with what's happening to our country today.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
I mean, I was struck by this reading the book, and I've been struck by this in the past. But it feels, in our conversations recently, there's something about you sound to me more like an elder than you ever could. And I mean that, you know, in a very respectful way, because we're almost the same age. I think there's something happening, though, around baby boomers moving towards elderhood. Maybe for the first time in the sort of grand kind of American experiment, there's a deepening. There's a multi-generational lens, both in terms of the people that are here now, but I hear people talking a lot more about deeper history, and your book points at history before the last 500 years of the corporation, deeper history. So I'm curious about your take as a baby elder.
Emerging. I prefer emerging elder,
an emerging
preferred
elder.
Pronoun.
An emerging elder in a country that feels like it's maturing and wanting to mature and wanting to find some eldership, and in terms of looking forward and actually thinking about future generations. So can you speak a little bit from that wider time frame?
Well, I think that first off, I think you're right. I think there is this shift that's underway, and I'm a what do you call it, like a late boomer. I kind of like just barely caught the baby boomer period, and so I think there's a generation kind of above me, if you will, who all of a sudden, you know, basically their parents are dead, their kids still hate them. And they're really grappling with kind of like, well, wait a minute, like what is success? What does this really mean? What is my place in any of this? And I think out of a place of profound love and concern for their kids, they are really starting to ask some very deep questions around their own lives, certainly, but also these broader questions that we've been exploring tonight. And I think that part of what is intriguing to watch is that you can almost see the same thing happen in terms of impact investing, which again is kind of like the entry point that I come into this conversation from, because you have this generational shift where now we've got all of this interest. We've got mainstream investment firms now doing this. If you enter impactinvesting.com in your browser, you get taken to BlackRock's website. I mean, who the fuck ever thought that would happen? And I think that a lot of folks are kind of saying, okay, so we've got the tools, But what is the task? Like, what are we really about? What are we really trying to do? And I think that this is part of why I've actually been kind of surprised at the response to the book, because I actually thought, I kind of thought it was going to be like a bloop and just kind of drop and disappear. And, you know, we're giving it away digitally, and we've had like 1,500, I think almost 2,000 downloads in just like, 6 weeks or something since we released it. And I think there's a lot of folks who are saying, who want to go there. People want to have this conversation. And there's this understanding that there's this generational turn, if you will, that the asset owners who created wealth and capital in the first generation, by the time they look at second and third generation family members, are realizing that something's been lost and that there's an opportunity that the wealth offers to engage in a different conversation, a different discussion. And that just happens to fit with this whole critique of, you know, income inequality, of asset inequality. I mean, all of these social issues that really are the broader community and collective manifestation of these individual events, if you will. And so the grappling of, what do you do with your money? What's, you know, do you do a foundation? Do you do investing? Do you, you know, how do you create value beyond financial return is a central one that I think these generations are really grappling with. David Brooks had an article, I think it was today, called Liberal Parents, Radical Children, that talked about the fact that, you know, for a lot of the boomer generation, they still believe that capitalism can create positive change, that, you know, liberal democracy is still something to be defended. And their kids have basically, you know, lived a different experience. You know, if you were a 20-something and you were around during this 07, 08, 09, you have a much different perspective around financial security and economics than baby boomers did. And so I think this is part of the fundamental of stepping back and having a different discussion around our understanding of economics, our understanding of the purpose of capital, our understanding of whether financial return should even be a consideration relative to performance and value creation, or if it's just one more kind of incremental tool that we use to just track some aspect of performance.
I'm curious about sort of the next level of that, where your example of sort of experiential wealth management and this sort of my take is that right now, particularly millennials and Gen Z, it's a very experiential generation. They're really interested in not just buying stuff, but how do you invest in a life? How do you experience much more dramatically? And Burning Man and lots of the festivals are, I think, a piece of that story. But how do we pull together right now? How do we become what I describe sometimes as the biggest we in human history, which it feels like we need to. We need to be the end of the movie The Martian, where everyone's focused on bringing this one dude back from Mars to Earth. And there's something really gestalt and powerful about that moment with people all over the world in the street doing this one really big thing together. So what does that look like in terms of capital and pulling us together, the 99 and the one, across generations, millennials, women, and the good dudes, right? How does that happen?
Right. I you know, and again, it sounds flip because we're in California, so I can say this, but I think that we need to have a shift in our capital consciousness. I mean, I really think all we're talking about is we need to understand that how we approach capitalism, how we approach economics, are simply social constructs. All we have done has been to inherit this set of ways of thinking and tools and practices that were created 100 years ago, 400 years ago. I mean, and that's it. But we live against a 20,000-year human experience of being on the earth. And we can reconceive, we can redefine the nature and purpose of capital in a way that I still don't feel we have. There are initiatives, there are groups, there are organizations that are, you know, beginning to try to do that. But as a community, as a country, we certainly have not done that. And that's the opportunity that we have, is to really understand that we've created this. This is not something, the way we approach economics, the way we understand capitalism, the way all this works, is not like somehow God-given and that we cannot change and modify this. It's not like it came from, you know, God's hand, Alan Greenspan's 12C calculator. It's kind of like, you know, we created this and we can create it anew. We can redefine this. We can have different terms. And this is where, you know, again, kind of liberating the capitalists is kind of an odd thing to call for. But if you shift how these folks think about the nature and purpose of their wealth, you open up opportunities for the broader community as a whole, as well as for them. And you begin to move to, you know, what some folks call the moving from me to we, you know, like what you described. And when you do that economically, you're not calling for socialism. And you're not calling for capitalism in a new form. You're calling for a different approach to economics and the more original kind of Greek understanding of economics, which is providing for the household. And that's really what we have to rediscover is that idea. And we can't get there if we're oppositional alone. I mean, we need to be challenging each other. We need to recognize that there are differences. We need to really understand that people are dying like right now because of our economic system. And we can't just stop at the place of saying people are dying because of the economic system. There's a project that's driven by a group of artists out of Europe called the Dark Mountain Project that I really like because they, and this goes back to the climate change issue, their posture is to say we should spend as much time exploring solutions as we need to, but we should understand that what we really first have to do is come up with a different understanding of how we are called to be present in the face of climate change and the ecocide of the earth. And that's the first step, is to say we need to rethink, you know, how we're called to be as we seek to become whatever it is that we need to move to if we're all going to survive. And they do this through their art, through their writing, through their music, and through convenings that they've had. My wife's Norwegian, Mia, and we were up at the most far out spot of Norway that you could think of. I mean, the town is actually called O, which is AA, which is the last letter of the Norwegian alphabet. This is how far out this place was. And we're walking along and we go into this little shop and they actually had a book that was the story of the experiences of Norwegian artists bringing together capitalists, business people, community residents, miners to explore a different conversation about the planet and the earth from an experiential kind of artistic basis. And I was like, man, like, this is so great because we got to break out. And I don't think we can understand the Anthropocene unless we understand the Axial Age, which is kind of where a lot of this, I think, started. And we can't understand any of it outside of having a different experience of self and community. And that this is the opportunity. And it's a phenomenal opportunity. And then the last thing I'll say is that in just simply shutting up and reading, over time, I don't have like any kind of spiritual practice. I'm like a really crummy Christian. I'm a bad Buddhist. I mean, all that stuff, right? But I just moved into this place from being contemplative where I suddenly felt this weight kind of lift off of me because I kind of realized, you know, like I am so insignificant to any of this and I am so critical to play my role that I'm called to play. And yet I will do that and the world will probably continue to die. But in some sense, it's almost, that's not really relevant because the issue is kind of like, what am I called to do? How am I called to be in this place? And I can't know what I'm supposed to do unless I pause to consider my sense of presence and self in the context of other, in the context of environment, in the context of community. And we don't allow for that because we're bombarded by constant like punditry and commentary and bullshit that distracts us from these more fundamental questions of self and other. Sorry about that. Kind of went off on a whole thing there.
Great. But maybe this is the right moment to pause and to invite the community to come up and join us in this discussion. And what are the things that we can say together this evening?
So you mentioned on page 107 in your book about Adam Smith, about his invisible hand. He is in this way, as in many other cases, led by an invisible hand to promote an end that was no part of his intention. Well, he also wrote of an invisible hand in a book called The Theory of Moral Sentiments, mm-hmm. 17 years prior. In that, he says, they are led by an invisible hand to make nearly the same distribution of the necessaries of life which would have been made had the earth been divided into equal portions among all its inhabitants. That's a pretty cool invisible hand. And he ends it by saying, and affords a means to the multiplication of the species. So with that being said, the New Yorker the New York Magazine had an article today. They gave 5 points for how we can reverse this madness. Number one, rethink how we farm. Number two, build for the future, not the past. Number three, retreat from the coasts. Bad news for 70% of the financial markets, since that's where they're located. Enlist nature to help. And then finally, expect the unexpected. So how do we shape and form capital into this to share the necessaries of life as if the earth had been divided equally among all its inhabitants?
Sure.
And then try to work on these 5 points, because we got 3 years,
right?
Not 12.
Right. Well, I first off, love all that. I think what the real tragedy for Adam Smith is that he is viewed as an economist by most people who think about him, and he wasn't. And I find it striking that the invisible hand line, I think there is in one time, one use, yeah? And people have focused on that as if it was a tweet, right? And kind of like, this is what, you know, Adam Smith was saying. And yet, as you just said, if you read, you know, Moral Sentiments and you read Wealth of Nations, you have a very different, I think, perspective. And I think we, all of us, kind of often we're tempted to kind of seek out things that validate our perspective. And this is, in fact, what has happened in the destruction, really, of some of the great writing that he has done that's been really left to the side. I think that what you described as the 5 points that were mentioned is exactly what I'm calling for in the sense of, in the context of capital, that we need to really rethink distribution of capital away from the coast, that we need to rethink the connection of capital to nature and environment. We need to rethink issues of ownership and what it means to own anything, especially in this day and age. But I think that historically, we tend to think of the commons as being the tragedy of the commons. And in fact, I don't know, if you look at North America, the commons worked really well for, you know, literally centuries and centuries and centuries before the individualistic kind of capitalist perspective was brought to bear. So I think that all of the things that you pointed out is exactly the framing for the kind of conversation that we need to have. And in the book, I specifically don't end with here's the 5 points of purpose or here's an agenda or any of that, because my concern is that unless you pause first to really open yourself up to have a different conversation, then you're not going to hear the truth of these 5 kind of solutions that we should explore, because you'll be in this defensive posture of kind of, this is how we should think about this. This is the strategy and the solution. And so I couldn't agree more with everything that you just laid out. I think it's great. And we need to bring that kind of thinking exactly into this discussion.
I just wanted to start by saying thank you to Donna and Jed for instigating this conversation. It's a conversation I've been spending a lot of time thinking about myself, and I'm involved in the technology industry here, and I've gotten deep into incentive systems. And so I see this capitalism we keep talking about as sort of a monoculture of commerce with its orthodoxy of transaction, debt, and credit. And there are certain economists that I've been reading, for instance, David Graeber, and Kate Raworth, who wrote Don't Know Economics, who talk and help you to sort of broaden your perspective to realize, for instance, in debt, the first 5,000 years, that there have been hundreds of systems of commerce, in all likelihood, even going back into prehistory, that have worked for different populations at different times. And we've created this Leviathan that has run amok and created, you know, the equivalent of like the only plant is corn. So the first challenge to me is this imaginative challenge. The second challenge is, and this, I don't know if we disagree on this, is this notion of reform versus subversion or revolution. And so I'd love to hear from that, because for me, no matter how much we put progressive taxation, regulation, rule of law, no matter how much we curtail the excesses of capitalism, we're screwed. Smart people and smart capital is going to work around and play parties off of each other, if this is the dominant system, to accumulate massive pools of wealth and to totally deplete the earth. Right? There's three things. There's wealth polarization, hyperconsumption, and this tragedy of the commons, this depletion of the biosphere. So maybe can you talk a little bit about that? Do we reform capitalism the way that it's operated, or do we need to create new subversive systems that render capitalism essentially obsolete?
Yes.
Love that.
So,
but this is yeah, but this is the liberal parent radical child conversation, is this sense of kind of like, can you in fact do this? And I think that where you stand depends on where you sit. And over time, I was quote, very radical in a white boy going to college kind of way in my 20s. I became really frustrated with what happened. Like I came here to San Francisco. I was the founding director of the Larkin Street Youth Center. I had a whole career in the nonprofit sector that left me crushed, just left me like fed up, because the way money moved, and this is in the 80s, so maybe it's different now, but the way money moved at that time was on the basis of politics, perception, and persuasion, and not performance. And we were running a street program for homeless kids. We would get a lot of kids, and we would get, the money would not follow the kids, because the organizations were funded based on either, their ability to get government contracts or whatever it was. And so I basically blew out of that frame and said, I don't want to have anything to do with traditional nonprofits, philanthropy, or government, because I'm just done, and that's what brought me into social entrepreneurship. Because what I said was, look, there is a community of disillusioned social workers who are running business ventures to provide transitional employment for formerly homeless people, and are basically trying to run, market-based businesses with the employees that their for-profit competitors have already fired and that the nonprofits view as too fucked up to go through a training program, right? And so, that was a passion, but it was definitely not part of either of those things. And then over time, I think I became more and more co-opted by this, this idea that we can just modify a little here, we can do a little here, and we have to, because gosh, if everything falls apart, then we're really screwed, right? And then 07 came, 08 came, 09 came. And I kept waiting for all these business people who were supposed to be very rational and very like, let's look at the numbers, let's do this, with an objective perspective. And they didn't. And they didn't stop. And they didn't question the fundamental premise of, of modern portfolio theory. They didn't reflect on wealth. They didn't reflect on this very system that they brought crashing to its knees, right? And I was just like equally disillusioned, because we miss this phenomenal opportunity to really to argue and to have a different discussion about what purpose should our economics serve. And now I'm kind of like going to this place of kind of radical Buddhist action. Because I think that I really do believe that we cannot, I can't engage with you in a dialogue around where we need to go together if I'm separated from myself. And I think that we need to do work on ourselves as we're working on creation of community and connection and collaboration. And this is the challenge. And this is what pisses me off when I look at what's happened in the impact investing space, because you have now, with the big institutions coming in, I got to tell you, I know it's a shock. I don't think Goldman Sachs and BlackRock give a shit about reforming capitalism, right? Hard to believe, I know. And I feel like what we've done has been to kind of validate these practices. And we've basically underscored the idea that the wealth holder is the only one that we should care about, the only one who should call the shots about what happens to their money. And I think we have a different conversation that we have to blow open. I don't know where that goes. I don't know if there are ways to modify and reform, And maybe there are, and maybe there are things that just need to be blown up, like our understanding of ownership, like our understanding of the definition of return as being more than financial. And if all we did, quote unquote, was to blow open our understanding of return to be inclusive of environmental and social performance together with economic performance, that alone would change the dynamic of how we understand what it means to be sustainable, what it means to be profitable. I mean, all of those things. So I think there are some things that need to be blown up. But I know that Donna has been sitting on this question for many years. And so is it reform or is it revolution, Donna? What do you think?
It depends what day you ask me and what sort of moment in my life. But I think one of the pieces for me that dovetails with what you're saying about it starts with our own consciousness. There's something about the story of this moment. And yes, there's a blow-up story and a little tinkering story that seems to be the two dominant stories that are happening. But there is something, I think, starting to show up in the spaces between. Mm. Not a middle way, not a wishy-washy kind of middle, but from thoughtful, meaningful listening and dialogue that's starting. And I think this recent election saw the most women, the most gay people, the most Muslims elected to this country. And I think that's the beginning of this idea that the story of this moment isn't just changing the how, and even getting to why, but it is also changing the who, that by changing who, we actually do really have the chance of doing radical shit, that matters. But there's this other story, I think, that comes back a little bit to the story of Adam Smith and the neoliberal story that we've all swallowed since the Powell Memorandum, right? We've been living this playbook that was laid out for us by very, very, very focused people who decided they were going to build textbooks and university programs and think tanks and media outlets, and they were going to tell their neoliberal story of what the economy is until we all bought it, swallowed it, regurgitated, and lived it. And I think we're at this moment of it's bullshit. And it hasn't worked. And it's been catastrophic. That form of capitalism is completely destructive. And so for me, there's something about pausing, being reflective, being thoughtful, and then pulling people together to tell a fundamentally different story. And for me, that story starts with the sun, which I think is the ultimate symbol of abundance. And what I grieved over the last couple of weeks when we couldn't see the sun, I realized how much I was a human attached to every morning seeing the sun, and that actually renewed me in a spiritual way, and it had my whole life. And I think we have this opportunity right now to look at the sun and think about abundance really differently by moving $2 trillion a year, every year for the next 30 years into solar energy, and making sure that the majority of that solar development is owned by communities. Because when communities own solar panels, they think they're beautiful, and it stirs the soul. And when corporations own the solar panels, it's not the same thing. And so somehow I think we're in a solar moment, a solar story of abundance and feeling like we can do something really big. But we only do it really big and really well if we share the benefit.
No, but I think this issue of who controls the narrative is just really important in the context of capital. Because, and this again is part of my concern around the entry of the large financial institutions, because I think what's happening is they're buying the mic, and they are starting to control the narrative of how do you define impact? What does it mean to be an impact investor? Can you have impact at scale? Of course you can. And we happen to have a product that does just that. You know, it's kind of like... And I think that we need to be very careful about this very point. And I mean, it's one of the reasons, quite frankly, that I self-published this book, because I didn't want to have to deal with a publisher. I didn't want to have to deal with sales numbers and kind of having somebody tell me how much my book should be sold for. And it's kind of as a rejection of that whole thing. I just wanted to be in control of my own kind of narrative to try to bring people into a connection to this broader, deeper conversation that I think humanity has been having for centuries. And it's such a rich thing for us to participate in and to bring it forward as we own the new conversation about the future of the planet and sun.
So first of all, I wanted
to make it a question.
It will be a question. it will be a question. So I wanted to ask you about the larger, you talked about high net worth people and getting people to engage in conversation. And I am thinking about our 401k plans, our 403b plans. I am thinking about the pension plans. And I'm thinking about a retired teacher who is relying on their pension, and the pension maybe is investing in a private prison or in God only knows what else, and yet this person needs to live, and how that pause and that conversation might happen in those big things. And it's really, really hard to find good options, even like managing a 401k plan for a community development financial institution, which I work for. So,
right. No, I think it's a great question. And actually, Donna, you spent a lot of time in the last couple of years on this issue of how do you take impact retail and how do you democratize capital for the folks who aren't ultra high net worth. And I'm certainly not ultra high net worth. So I'm very interested in your response.
It's bloody hard. So in my previous incarnation with Change Finance, we were a majority women's activist finance team building products that didn't invest in slavery, sex trafficking, climate change. And we're back to fear again, because one of the largest impediments to new financial companies and new financial products coming into the marketplace and actually catching on and spreading is that the system is set up that if you don't have 3 years track record, you're not investable. If you don't have $100 million invested in your product, you're not investable. And so we're actually living in a moment in time where we, the people, have incredible power over our capital, except that most of the financial organizations and the gatekeepers, whether they're the fiduciaries at the pensions, whether they're a more conventional wealth manager, even a radical wealth manager, they won't move assets into financial products that don't have financial and time frame track record. Well, there are no financial products on the marketplace that are really clean, that have 3 year track records or $100 million in them. It doesn't exist. So we have to get really brave, and we have to take back our money and do it and work with Paul Herman and Hip Investor, or work with the Change Finance, the new players in on the scene, because conventional finance is still so locked down by fear. It is the most fear-centered industry. And I worked in tax policy. I worked in energy. I ain't seen nothing like the fear frequencies within the House of Finance. It is a terrified, quivering bowl of jelly. And if we want different, if we want our values to be aligned with our money, we have to do it and say it. And particularly women and millennials, as people are inheriting capital, we have to set really different standards and say, my money will not go out at night and do hideous things. I'm not going to be invested in harm. I'm not going to destroy the world and compromise human dignity with my capital. I will not do that. And then stand really firm and invest in things that are young and new and radical and driving change.
Well, and I think what we need to do is that, in addition to knowing what you own, you have to like own what you know about what your wealth is doing. And so it's not enough to kind of look for an SRI fund and kind of like we're done. And, you know, I'm reminded of in the late 1800s in the state of New York, endowments and fiduciaries of endowments were only allowed to invest in bonds that were offered by, wait for it, the state of New York, right? And it was not the legislative body or the regulators who came to the fiduciaries and said, gee, you know, like we made a mistake. You know, you should have broader diversified portfolios. It was the fiduciaries who came to the regulators in the state and said, we have a responsibility, we have an obligation, we have an opportunity to do better for the institutions that we're charged with overseeing the wealth management of. And I think that the trick here in this conversation, at least in part, is that we now have created this institutionalized structure where fiduciaries understand their duty in a certain way that has got to change. And that change and that comprehension will only come if the actual owners of the capital, you know, if the union members, if the teachers, if, you know, the whomever, don't stand up and really say to their pension funds, you know, we need to explore these things. You can, in fact, you know, protect our financial interest while taking consideration of the planet and engaging in climate change, positive kind of investing strategies. I mean, we know how to do a lot of this. This is simply tools and techniques, but without the will, without a different consciousness around the purpose of our capital and wealth, we're not going to get there. And having the tools is not going to save us. And Martin Luther King Jr. talked about how we have guided missiles and misguided men. And this is what we have. We have phenomenal creativity around financial structuring, derivatives, credit default swaps, the whole nine yards that have driven us to this place of basically bartering the planet and our children for a future that will basically be a future of death. And somehow that's okay because our mindset is simply on this quarter, on our life, on our returns. And we need to fundamentally kind of reframe that whole conversation. And that's, I think, what we're both trying to say is that this is that moment, this is that time, this is that generation that is called to step up and step into that conversation. First, I think, with ourselves, to really get honest and truthful and to look in the mirror and say, what am I really leaving my children? Like, what is the real legacy of my life? And if that is simply, you know, a larger pile of cash, and if the purpose of capital is simply its own replication, then we're in serious trouble. I would argue that for most people, that's not the case, and that we're not having these discussions. We're not pushing them forward in a meaningful, kind of open way, and we have this opportunity to do that, and I would hope that we all take up the challenge and take advantage of that opportunity. So thank you. Really, I appreciate your coming out on a rainy night that's really dark. but I hope that everybody got a free copy of the book. And I think there's few enough folks who didn't. If you didn't, let me know and I'll send you a free copy. So
thank you, Jed.
Thanks
thank
so much.
You, Donna. I want to thank Jed Emerson in conversation with Donna Morton for their comments here today. We also thank our audience here at the club, as well as our radio audience. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you all for coming.